Hey, Startup Hustle listeners, before we get into today's episode, I've got some exciting news to share. If you've enjoyed the insights and stories here at Startup Hustle, you're going to love what we have in store at our brand new podcast called Product Driven. I've always described myself as a product guy first, entrepreneur, software engineer, but really a product guy. I love building products. Many people struggle, though, with how to take a product idea and build a tech product, while software engineers struggle to understand the business side of things and they just don't see the big picture. My new podcast, Product Driven, is about that gap between business and the tech side of building software. It's designed for startup founders, tech leaders, software engineers, and anyone who loves tech and startups. Thank you for being part of this community. Enjoy this episode of Startup Hustle, and please subscribe to Product Driven in your podcast app, and you can also check it out on YouTube. Thank you so much.
And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io.
And we're back for another episode of the Startup Hustle. This is your host today, Matt Watson. Very excited to be joined today by Jeff Weiner. He's the founder and CEO of Real Quantum. And today we're going to talk about product strategy for startups, which is always a problem when you have small customers, enterprise customers. How do you handle the roadmap? How do you handle product ideas? How do you deal with all of those problems? We're going to talk more about that today, and I'm sure a lot of other things. Before we get started, I do want to remind you today's episode is brought to you by Fullscale, which is my company. We have hundreds of software developers in the Philippines working for dozens of other startups and scale-ups, front-end, back-end, mobile, QA, whatever it is you need help with, we can help you. Check us out at fullscale.io. Jeff, welcome from Kansas City, home of the world champions.
Woohoo. Yes. Thank you, Matt. Good to be here.
Yeah. So to get started, you're the founder and CEO of Real Quantum. Why don't you tell us a little about Real Quantum and what it is that you guys do?
Sure. So I should say I'm one of the co-founders. So I've been CEO for the last couple of years. And Real Quantum is a software as a service product, specifically in the vertical for commercial real estate appraisal. And we cover North America, U.S. and Canada, and serve mostly appraisers, but also some government agencies and things like that. So it's a full stack process and solution for the appraisal workflow. And we've been at it since about 2018 when we did our MVP, and we've had the experience to work with customers from sole proprietors on up to large enterprises.
So what led you guys to the idea to start this company? Did you have a background in commercial real estate, or what gave you guys the idea?
So I've been a software person my whole career, but my co-founders are professional, long-term commercial appraisers. And the deal with commercial appraisal, essentially it's a financial consulting exercise, right? And so there's a lot, which is pretty common in a lot of other disciplines too, is that it's a lot of very manual work, a lot of Word templates, a lot of Excel formulas and things like that. And commercial real estate, like prop tech overall, has really not ridden the technology innovation wave that other industries have, right? And so commercial real estate, in particular appraisal, is very document driven. So these fundamental things that, you know, Matt, that the sales platform world or the database and IT world solved decades ago, having a database, being able to repeat your process, having the ability to collaborate online at the same time, backups that are geo-redundant, you know, these basic fundamentals of technology, security, productivity, efficiency had not made it to this discipline, this industry. The thing is that commercial appraisal is this thing that happens behind the scenes whenever somebody buys, sells, borrows money, builds a new commercial property of any type. But it's the grease and the gears that makes this like $14 trillion US piece of the economy operate. So it was really screaming for help. So my My co-founders that are appraisers, they've been using some old tech. My CTO now got in contact with them in kind of a roundabout accidental way. You know, that's how some of these things happen sometimes. Got together, we're talking about it. And basically he said, you know, you guys are in the wrong business. You should be in the software business. So idea was born. I joined shortly thereafter. And we've ended up being the only pure SaaS product in this industry.
That's super surprising. There's nobody else is doing this.
Everybody else that's doing it is, so first of all of us, like many other financial B2B related apps, Excel is our real competitor, right?
Yeah.
Excel and the status quo. But the other ones that are out there, basically it's network database connected through elaborate and brittle macros to a Microsoft Office and make all that work together. And so we're the only ones that managed to actually do this whole thing pure SaaS.
So do you guys specialize in doing a single appraisal, or is it more about I own 20 buildings and I'm constantly trying to deal with the valuation of, you know, the whole portfolio of buildings that I own?
Yeah. So the biggest customer segment we have are what's known as a fee appraiser. So basically it's a third party, a consultant that goes and says, okay, I'm going to do the standard set of best practices that I've been trained to do and credentialed to do. That's going to determine the value of this property, either as it is or as it might be, right? So you think of as it might be, the term is called highest and best use, right? So great, industrial building in the heart of the city, great bones built in the 1900s, somebody wants to convert it into loft apartments, right? That's a potential use. So they have to do a lot of analysis to do that. There's a tremendous amount of financial, and there's a lot of judgment and studying of market trends and things like that. Those are all the tools that they use to decide either what its value is now or what it could be. All that workflow is what we do in there. And so these fee appraisers, they'll contract jobs on a recurring basis like other contractors. And most of their work comes from banks when it comes, you know, Matt's going to buy some property and he's going to convert this industrial building into some super cool lofts downtown, right? So he wants to go get a loan. So he's the loan. The bank says, all right, you need an appraisal. That's where my customers come in. And they do that on a recurring basis for, you know, hundreds of customers a year.
So I'm curious, how is COVID and everybody working remote and how that's affected the kind of office market? You know, how has that potentially affected your guys' business and what you do? Has that created more work and more demand for your service because people need more appraisals? Like, how has that affected you guys?
Right. So the appraisal industry is, so what people tend to say, what we found is, so appraisers are busy when values are going up for property. They're even busier when values are going down.
Yeah.
And so the challenge is in the middle. So there's like for COVID, the governments all over the world did all these interest rate cuts. And so there was this flurry of refinancing. It happened in residential too, right? All of us, we go out and refinance our houses, right? So there's all this refinancing. And so in spite of the fact that everybody had all these lockdown restrictions, there was all this work to do. And they were just burning the candle at both ends for a couple of years. And that was great for them and it was great for us. We grew a lot during that time. Then the interest rates started creeping up and deals went plummeted down. So appraiser bank work has dropped for many, in the U.S. at least, 30 to 50% in 2023 versus what it was in 22.
Yeah.
Many people left the business and there were already not enough appraisers. So it's created, because now the expectation is the smart money is 3 rate cuts this year. We'll see. The last inflation report was a little bit higher than expected. But anyway, presuming that there'll be some uptick in activity and there's been a lot of debt, right? You mentioned offices and people embracing remote work and hybrid work, and office buildings are emptier than they've ever been. All those office buildings, and some of it's getting into the national news, is like, Boston is worried that they're going to have a $1 billion shortfall in tax proceeds because of all these empty buildings in the Central Business District. I mean, there's real human implications to kit the trash, fill in the potholes and things like that as a result of this phenomenon that's happening. Well, the way that that impacts us at our company and our users is that those buildings are all basically on balloon loans, right? After a couple of years, they have to be refinanced. Well, if your vacancy went from 4% to 38% or whatever,
yeah,
you could be there's going to be trillions of dollars over the next decade or so of properties that are not worth what they used to be.
Yeah, and I know it's not really related to you or our conversation right now, but like China has the same problem. Like all of China has like major financial issues because of all of that. It's like, this might be a worldwide phenomenon in some other places too.
It is. So the Fed chair talked a little bit about the fact that it's going to be this issue we're going to be dealing with here in the US for several years. China has, what they have is they have a situation where they've had this years or decades long government support of building like crazy.
Yeah.
And they can't afford to keep doing it. And so they've started to back off and they've had some gigantic foreclosures and businesses fail. So, but in our case, definitely is that there's going to be a lot of price corrections.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the bottom line is that activity for our customers is going up, not always for good reasons, but our business is going up.
Well, I'd love to talk to you more about product and product strategy, you know, as a key topic today. And I guess my first question for you is, how do you, you know, like when you started this company, how did you approach product and kind of the idea, working with customers, validating the idea, market research? Like, where did you kind of start when it comes to product?
Right. So for us, we have kind of, I've said it a little bit before, we have a little bit of an embarrassment of riches when it comes to internal domain knowledge about what we need to do.
Yeah.
And that's really exciting. So the first step in our product strategy, it started pretty textbook, right? So we believed we had a good idea. We did a ton of customer research, which wasn't hard to do because of the domain expertise that we had access to. We formulated a basic concept of our various ideal customer profiles that we saw and started going out and testing those things. So we did the customer research. We also have the benefit of there being a set of best practices. So there's a acronym called USPAP, Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practices, right? So USPAP is to commercial appraisal what GAAP is to accounting in the U.S., right? It's a set of best practices that everybody has to follow. So that has, to a certain extent, it's a recipe guide for all the things that the product at least needs to do from the basis, right? So customer research and the real need is basic set of principles that you have to follow. And then from there, we attacked the whole problem as a reimagining, right? So when we were setting the stage for this conversation, we talked about the fact that our competition is Excel, right? So we knew the user flows through an Excel experience. So we, my co-founders and I I was really impressed with the eye for user experience design that a couple of my co-founders had that had no experience doing that before. They were just domain experts that could stand apart from the problem and look at it. And then we have some pretty amazing technology folks and we're able to translate that into user flows, into user experience. And so that's how we got our MVP up and running, right? We picked what we thought was a really good set of base use cases that would be viable, not just a prototype. And we launched with that. And then just like many other places, we thought it was too much. Like I waited too long to launch it. And then we launch and we think, oh, dang, it's way smaller than we thought it was. Because real quantum is, I heard this term not that long ago. It's a creator tool, you know. So there's lots of transactional tools out there, like I want to buy something. I want to sign up for something. I need to renew my license, whatever it is, right? There's a lot of transactional products that are out there. And this is a creator product. And creator products just have a crap ton of features that you need to build. So fortunately, again, we had all that great domain expertise. It's just that our first MVP was a lot more minimum than I had thought when we first launched it. But we snagged 100 paid subscribers really fast. And the good thing about that is that we always were open to feedback, but boy, they were happy to oblige us, right?
So let me ask you, your customers are the appraisers. Are these mostly like individual small businesses, or are these large companies that are conglomerates that do appraisals like nationwide? Like, what does the typical customer look like?
Yeah. So appraisal firms are set up to a certain extent kind of like law firms, in that about half of appraisers in the US and Canada are sole proprietors.
Okay.
And there are hundreds and hundreds of small shops that range between, you know, 30 people, something like that. And then there's a smaller cluster of between 30 and 100. And then you can basically count on your fingers the number of US firms that are more than 100 people.
Okay.
And there's a handful of them that are unique in Canada as well. So that's really how they're organized. So we were setting off, we are definitely an SMB focused workflow. And that's where we started. So we follow the traditional, we start in SMB and we work our way up market as we add features.
So how has that gone? So you mentioned earlier when you launched the product, you're like, man, there are so many other things we still need to build. What were some of those things? Were some of those just things that you knew about that were kind of on the, you know, end of the roadmap, you know, on the later side of the roadmap, or were they things that you didn't even think about?
Yeah, all of that. So the good thing with us is because we chose a pure Ruby on Rails implementation, for those people that aren't familiar with it, it's an opinionated development environment. And there's a really tight linkage between the code and the database. And so in the right hands, it's a screaming fast way to build new features. It's not incredibly beautiful and animated because we deployed basically almost nearly zero JavaScript or anything like that on the front end for quite a while. And so what we started with was we had a pretty good idea about what we hadn't built yet, because we had crafted a specific set of use cases for very common sets of needs, right? Common core of business flows. So we knew that. And so we went in with our eyes open about the things we didn't build. We had all those on the roadmap. And so, as you can imagine, what we had to do then is we get our first, say, 100 subscribers in there, and then we're getting the flow of feedback of how we thought we were should do it. And we started adapting on those and had to work to prioritize between those and the new features. And it's that common problem that is part art and part science, right, of deciding, okay, I've got all these things that I need to do, and prioritizing the tuning of the existing features versus what new features are going to scoop you up the next big chunk of users. And that's how we focused.
So as you go up market to some of these, maybe more mid-market, starting into some enterprise accounts, what kind of features are they asking you for that are different?
So yeah, that's an important point. So there's two sets of things that just roughly speaking, you can divide it into. One of them were core capabilities of doing their profession, right? So core capabilities, use cases that are necessary for the different types of commercial appraisals that are done, right? And that's pretty broad. Our residential appraisal is single family home, townhouse, condo, you know, apartment building with less than four or fewer units in it, right? Commercial is shopping center, gas station, almond orchard, oil refinery, you know, all that stuff.
Oh, right? Geez.
All that stuff. It's crazy. And so there were many use cases that we could have gone down. But one of the things that we found is that a lot of SMB, small, mid-sized businesses focused on what they refer to as the four food groups: retail, office, industrial, multifamily. And then all those other more unique ones were mostly with specialized companies. So we didn't worry about the specialties, right? So the first thing is as we went up market, we had to do more of the capabilities that some of the smaller guys just never did, right? They can, the little one-person shops in Boise, Idaho, or Des Moines, Iowa are fine doing the four food groups and never have to do hardly any of the complicated stuff. But as we went up market, once we got into the 10 or more users range, and it was very important in the enterprise, like 400 or more users, workflow, right? And that's probably not surprising, right? You've probably seen that in a lot of different places, right? In your experiences with Fin Solutions and other stuff, right?
Yeah, enterprise features usually tend to be a lot of things that don't help the core product. They're more ancillary, like they need an extra report or, you know, single sign-on integration or more roles, right, and security and like, you know, like multiple account. Like I need to log in, I need to see multiple accounts, and then I need reporting across multiple accounts. Where when you're dealing with smaller accounts, they don't do any of that. Like it's, right, it ends up being user like a lot of these. Right? Yeah, it ends up being like a lot of things like that that don't necessarily help the normal person that's using the product on a daily basis. They're like weird enterprise reporting, security, you know, multi-tenancy, like all these sort of things that if you're a big company, those are like mission critical. You couldn't work without them, right? Like if somebody had, you know, 50 appraisers, I'm sure there are multiple cities and like, well, we need reporting by metro area or we need reporting based on our oil refineries versus the apartments versus the commercial real estate or whatever. Where for a smaller client, you're like, they probably only do one of those things. They don't do all three of them. So like, right, there's just different kinds of users that you end up dealing with, and they have just different requirements than you normally would think of.
You're absolutely right. So, and it varies, right? So when it comes to, so this core function that occurs, say commercial real estate appraisal, right? And it lives in smaller firms, it tends to live, the firm only does that. But once the firms start to get bigger, they start to, yeah, do other things that would make sense, right? Sometimes they do brokerage, sometimes they do property management or whatever, right? So when the firms get a little bit bigger, we had the advantage of some workflow is necessary. Some of that, which you know, single sign on and hierarchical access and things like that, those were necessary, but they actually had some existing things in place like Salesforce or an ERP tool or something like that. And they were satisfied to run that and then link to us. So we didn't have to build too much of that. The one thing though that we did run into is as the firms get bigger, they do, like you mentioned, right, they do more complicated types of assignments, right? So the jobs that they get are more complex. So that really pushed us to expand that core feature set to those things that we hadn't needed to do before. Double-edged sword, because on one hand, hey, we can go now market to more of those bigger firms that do the more complicated work. On the downside is that now to get my money's worth, I've got to sell to those other big guys. And the big guy needs, and there are fewer of them, right? There's a handful. You can, like I said, you can count on your fingers the ones that have more than 200 yeah. people, right? The thing is that there are thousands and thousands and thousands of little guys. So that comes into that competition between, do we really need this elaborate stuff to accommodate these, you know, how many appraisers are going to need to handle rent control? Where does that occur? Well, New York City and maybe a little bit in San Francisco. That's it. Now, the amount of revenue that those people generate in New York City is tremendous. But, you know, I've got tens of thousands of other appraisers across North America that couldn't care less. So I experienced the good and the bad of this. I heard going in after we had our first big enterprise customer, in Real Quantum, said, hey, you really need to set up separate product teams, because otherwise the enterprise is going to suck all the air out of the room and your little guys aren't going to get the attention they need. And you need to have a steady stream of those people coming in and not churn, right? So you need to make sure you don't forget about them. So we were just so overloaded with work, we really couldn't do that. So we couldn't set up two individual product teams because we had basically every who in Whoville was building new features. And so we did have a problem for a while where we were not accommodating as many of the needs. And mostly those little, the small companies, they weren't asking for big new changes. They're asking for tuning. But those tuning changes can make a big impact on productivity, right? That kind of thing. So that was a tough lesson to learn. But I definitely agree with that advice. If it's at all possible, you have to have two different teams or at least two different product managers, depending on how big your team is. One worrying about enterprise, somebody else worrying about SMB.
I do want to take a second to remind everybody that if you need help with the four main food groups of software development, FullScale can help you with that. So front end, back end, mobile, QA. I was waiting a long time to say that because I thought it'd be funny. You can check us out at fullscale.io. If you need to hire software developers, that's what we do. Front end, mobile, back end, all the stuff. You know,
can your software developers address my dietary restrictions? It's really
cool. Yes, no problem. We can work with your food groups. The only challenge you have there is we have two different development teams or product groups kind of working. You know, a lot of the work is going to overlap, right? It's like, hey, they're working on the same product. And then it gets into like, then how do you organize the code, right? It's almost like, okay, I need them working on different applications or different parts of the code so they're not fighting with each other on a daily basis. We have two different teams that are like trying to change different modules or features or functions. Mm-hmm. But it makes sense if it's like, hey, well, this one's working on reporting and this one, they're working on integrations, they're working on like this kind of stuff over here that's kind of a little different and doesn't really fight with some of the other core part of the product. Like, have you had experience like trying to do that?
Yeah, that's an important point because there are different types, like you said. Sometimes the enterprise needs will be bold and there'll be an entirely new thing to stand up.
Like a whole new reporting system.
Like a reporting system or, you know, or a big data integration with a BI tool or something like that. The problem comes in when there's a big fundamental change that touches everything.
Yeah.
Single sign-on, which was supposed to be simple, turns out it just touched all these little places across login for everybody. And even though everybody, right, didn't have to do single sign-on, you, of course, have to take your whole credentialing and login process for everybody and change it to conform.
I laugh because, you know, I use like Auth0 or one of these tools. It's supposed to make it easy, but then I just fight with trying to get it to work. Like it's never as easy as it sounds. Security, things like security and billing and a lot of this like hidden plumbing stuff are like the death of so much like time that's gets wasted that nobody ever considers.
Yeah, that is so true. And it goes back. I mean, it's a Dilbertism, right? Is that anything that you don't understand must be simple.
So let me ask you this though, because I think one of the other things that's really different about enterprise software, I'm curious how this has impacted you guys, is integrations. You know, so as you work with these larger firms, are they like, oh, we want you to integrate with, you know, our accounting system or ERP system or like all these other things that, you know, a smaller customer doesn't use any of those things. They may use Excel to run their business on a day to day, but then they use your product as well. Where bigger firms like, we don't use Excel for our scheduling and dispatching and all these things. We use this other big complicated system and now you need to integrate with that.
So that's where, that's important, right? So I've always been, and this isn't just Real Quantum, but always, is you want to minimize as much as possible the interdependencies between your enterprise customer and your company yourself. First of all, it keeps you from getting bogged down in their process because their process is designed around a bureaucracy to keep thousands and thousands of people on the same path. And ours is all about how screaming fast you can go every day. And so the more autonomy we have, the better. So the first way we did that is, here's an API, right to our API. And we separate them that way.
So yeah.
Do the integration to talk to us. Or if they wanted us to integrate with another vendor product, which we had a couple of, we've done those with customers and on our own. It's great. Introduce us to the vendor. We'll take care of the rest of it. And then that other vendor who also doesn't have the bureaucracy to deal with, we work together, we get it worked out. So the more you can separate yourselves, the better. The more that you can contract to eliminate interdependencies between the teams, the better. Not that we don't want to collaborate. We do. It's just that you got to eliminate the points of interdependency. Otherwise, you'll just get sucked into the red tape.
So another question I have for you, you know, from a product strategy perspective, you know, obviously marketing and product marketing is kind of related to product as well, but I'm just curious for your guys' business, how is going up market change your overall business model? You know, if you're selling to an individual appraiser, let's pretend they pay, you know, $500 for a product or whatever, versus you go to some big firm and they pay $5,000 a month for the product, you're going to have like how you market to those customers, how you sell to them, how you pay your salespeople commission is different. Like the sales cycle is different. That all affects so much about your business model as well, right? How is that like impact your thinking?
Yeah. I mean, when it comes to SMB and enterprise, it's rare that somebody can sell to both. And the models are different, right? And the messaging is different.
Yeah.
The good thing about, so what we ended up doing is that, first of all, the sales team was never overlapped. Enterprise was only focused on enterprise.
Yeah.
SMB was only focused on it. And you have different people. In the case of marketing, enterprise marketing for us is ABM, so account-based marketing. Get your list of targets. You do specific campaigns to target individual companies and you have a plan for each one versus broader marketing. And for us, the SMB is our target. And so we cast the net for the medium-sized fish. And if the little fish jump in, great, great. A very similar value proposition, but that's how we do it. So that's really important. And, you know, those two things are the primary areas. You know, we've built automations within HubSpot, our CRM, and a bunch of other things to make the SMB side really fast. Of course, as you know, enterprise is all about master service agreements and statements of work. And
yeah,
that's its own animal too, right? I don't need to pay a lawyer for SMB.
Well, but did it also change any of your product features? So maybe this doesn't apply to your product, but to a lot of people's product, like at Stackify, my previous company, our average customer only paid $250 a month. I really couldn't afford salespeople to set up demos and walk them through for a product that was price point. We need the product to be all self-service. Like they log in, they try it, they see value in it, they have that aha moment, they put their credit card in and they buy, right? Which is totally different than an enterprise account where you want to get them on the phone and you want to talk to them about the value and all that. But that also kind of change the product features, right? If we have to optimize for the self-service, we have to put all this work into the product to optimize for that self-service experience. I'm curious, you know, do you have any of those kinds of thought that I guess affected your company or other companies?
You know, we did okay there. Really what we had to do was we had to design our product organization to deal with our own product strategy and then negotiating or dealing with enterprise inputs to our product strategy. Those are the two that we had to deal with the most, right? So we had what we wanted to accomplish, which accommodated everybody from the sole proprietor on up to the large customer. And then we had enterprise needs about what they wanted to accomplish. And so we had, of course, various professional services dollars that were coming into the team to say, you know, we want this and this and this and this. We want data migration. We want to integrate with one of our systems, blah, blah, blah. And so it's easy to say, all right, anything that's specific to you, chop that off to the side. But then there's a set of enhancements that we have to make to the product because we're not forking the code for you guys, right? Mm-hmm. It's one product. So sorry, here's all the things we need to add to the product. So figuring out how to merge those two together was where we had to be careful. And so we did a couple of things. One is We negotiated and got agreement with all of our customers that we've had that have asked us for new product features is that every feature would be GA. Every feature is generally available. And that we architected our product so that the differentiators for that customer were in their configuration, not in the source code.
Yeah.
And that wasn't always easy, but we managed to do it. I credit some pretty amazing engineers and architects on my team. So we could say, look, you know, Enterprise One, Government Agency Two, whatever you guys, I know you want this stuff, but you're not going to be putting, your trade secrets are not in my source code. Your trade secrets are in your configuration, which only you see. We have to agree all these features I'm going to add, best practices and appraisal are not your secret sauce. Everybody's supposed to do them. So that's how we got past that. And that was crucial. And then we went back to that prioritization between big company needs and maybe not
yeah.
so big company needs. But, you know, I think we did the best we could. I said we didn't do as good as I would have liked to, but I think we did okay.
You bring up a good point, and this was a big problem that we had at Vint Solutions is it started out as a product and then kind of turned into a platform where it's like we had a bunch of different products on one platform and there were, you know, almost everything was sort of optional. Like you said, it's like we had all these levers and switches to turn off totally different modules. Like, oh, do you want CRM? Do you want a website? Do you want all these different things? The problem that we ran into, there were so many levers and switches. Nobody knew what half of them did. And it became so complicated. Like there was no support person in our company that understood how all the product worked, let alone what all the levers and switches like magically did. It's like, well, I do this thing, like what in the heck is going to happen on the other side? Like, I think that's part of the struggle with this too, as a company, it's like you're carrying a backpack up the mountain, right? And it's like every one of these things you keep throwing in your backpack. And it's like, now we got to support this switch for this one account. But now right. I got like 100 of them.
Yeah, that is so hard, Matt, right? So for me, I'm absolutely in the invest in making it simple. Because, right, simple is not easy. Simple is harder
yeah.
than making a complex user experience. So invest in simple. We have two flavors or two tiers of our product. Basically, the tier one is the basic and the tier two is an advanced. And we have a couple of add-ons. You know, I don't know, a handful, you know, a variety yeah. of add-ons. And so we implemented the two tiers, same code base. We implemented the two tiers with feature flags.
Yeah.
So basically we can then graduate a feature from the base tier to the advanced tier as we go, or I'm sorry, the other way around. We can send features down to the base product over time. And, that's how we accommodated government and enterprise and still kept an affordable product for the SMB.
Well, one of the challenges you have is you build this beautiful, simple product for an individual appraiser, and then you constantly have to fight like overcomplicating it, right? Like, oh, the enterprise wants all these, like this extra field, this extra button. And it's like a constant battle, right? Because eventually you may overcomplicate the user experience for just a basic appraiser trying to do their job.
It is so true. And so two different tiers is a little bit coarse-grained, I think. So we could end up with a third at some point, but so far we've stuck to two. And, you know, we talked about doing the individual things, and I think some of my competitors do the whole a la carte menu thing, and it's such a turnoff to the customer. It really is.
Because they just want to do their job. They don't want to be an expert at configuring software.
Right. And you're absolutely right. It's because you don't want, and there's a product, I forget what the thing is at this moment, right? But there's a product mindset is you don't want to force the 80% to have to see all
right.
the crap that the 20%
yeah, yeah.
needs to worry about.
Yeah.
You have to figure out how to do that. And it is an art to it. So that's what we've tried to do with the two tiers. And then so the first part was making sure that we're expanding our product without losing our soul, so to speak, right? We were going to add these features, but they had to be our product features.
Yeah.
We pushed back on stuff. We said, no, you're going to have to do that somewhere else. And it required a lot of finesse and negotiating.
And they will ask for terrible ideas.
Oh, yeah. You're going to host it locally. You're going to move it from AWS to Azure or whatever, right? You're going to you know, convert it to Java. I don't know. I asked all kinds of crazy stuff, right? You're going to fork the code. No, we're not doing any of that stuff. And so they got a much better product as a result of us staying to the core. But it really required a combination of working with the internal team, which in my experience, none of those enterprises, that's not fair. Rarely will the enterprise have a product mindset. It's either the business and the IT department, right? When I've gotten to work with product in a big enterprise is a different animal. There's all the product feature strategy, customer research, all that kind of stuff. But then there's this whole component of how to compete for resources in the big organization. Right? So there's a lot of that stuff. And it's important, you know, if you have the advantage of being able to create a new $1 billion revenue stream, amazing. Hopefully, if you do it right, there'll be a few pennies at the end of profit when you're done with it. But, you know, that's the price you pay for creating something enormous, right? You can create a unicorn. We talk about in the startup world, oh, I made a unicorn. Well, you know, actually big enterprises do that fairly often internally. It just doesn't come out the same way. So when I've had the opportunity to work with internal product, it is really helpful because they're thinking of it, they can relate to us as a product. They can see, we have this product, your product is a part of our product. That works really well. It's the enterprises that we work with that are more challenging that don't have a product mindset because we're either working directly with the business or with the business plus their IT organization, which thinks of it as more a software development life cycle. We do a project, we build this thing, we do the next thing, we, you know, that kind of stuff. And it's harder because they're all about custom.
Well, I'm kind of laughing in my head right now because one of the challenges that you inevitably deal with when you're dealing with large enterprise companies, and they don't have to be that large, but you're always fighting the, this is the way we've always done it syndrome, mm-hmm. right? And so it's like, they're going to come to you and be like, we need you to add this custom field and do this workflow this way and whatever. Not because any of it makes any sense at all. It's like, that's just the way we've always done it for 5 years ago. And this guy 5 years ago, who doesn't work here anymore, decided to do that way. So now for the last 5 years, we've just done it that way. So now your software has to do it that way. Like you're fighting that kind of stuff that is like totally arbitrary that now they want to force into your software. and sometimes you just have to give them the workaround, right? You're like, and we don't do it that way, but you do it this way.
So yes. So I had the benefit slash, you know, scars of having worked several years in big enterprise corporate IT. And I worked in the mobile communications business, which is absolutely cutthroat. Oh, my gosh. It's ruthless. So we had to work really hard. But that absolutely happens. And it's most people come into it, honestly, is that they have to really develop a domain expertise about how stuff actually works inside that company. It's very difficult and unusual for individuals to be able to have outside perspective.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons that attracted me to moving out of that space and being in a software development, because I wanted to build software and more that was happening outside the company. But also I saw when I worked with service providers and vendors, I thought, how do you know all this stuff? It's like I stood up and I figured out what everybody else was doing because that's my job. And that was such a breath of fresh air. So we try to do our best to bring that insight to them. Some people really embrace it and other people, they struggle. Yeah. But you're right. And the other thing too, is one more thing is sometimes it really helps to say, sorry, the product doesn't do that.
Yeah. Sometimes you just got to say no. And I real quick story. The worst product idea I ever heard at Ben Solutions. So it was a CRM system for car dealers, tracked everything to do with sales, everything. There was some dealership that wanted all the customer appointments for like, who's going to come do a test drive, who's going to come to the showroom today, want to be able to schedule all those, but did not want the salespeople to be able to see that the appointments were scheduled. I was like, no, we're not going to do that. It's like, if you don't want to use our software, that's fine, but we're not going to do that. Right. Sometimes they ask for the craziest things, man.
Well, you know, and people, Yes. Yeah. I had this story and I learned it when I was like 22, my first job out of college. And I was working with these super dynamic and creative guys who were managing network engineering, which is crazy. And they asked for these funny features like that. And I said, don't take this the wrong way, but it's like you're saying, you like to listen to the radio when you're unloading the groceries from your trunks. You want to have radio controls in your trunk. That's what you're telling me. You really want to do that? All right. And then he just said, shut up and get out of my office. Right. No, but that's a really good point. Is the other thing you do is as a product leader and a guide with these enterprises that are asking for these things is really help them step back and say, what are you trying to accomplish? Look at the tools and the process, because fortunately we've been thinking about this stuff from a systems view with no burden of the current process of that enterprise. And if you've come to them and built up enough trust, they actually do say, oh, that's pretty cool. I like that. And then they embrace it. And we've had a string of those in RoQuantum, and I've really enjoyed my last startup. We work with some pretty big companies there and it worked out well, but it takes time.
Well, it's been awesome having you on the show today. I do remind everybody, if you need help growing your software development team, check us out at fullskill.io. That's my company. Again, this is Jeff Weiner, one of the co-founders and CEO of RoQuantum. You can check him out at realquantum.com. Jeff, thank you so much for being on the show today. This is a great conversation about product strategy and SMB and enterprise. It's very great. Very good. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Matt, too, for having me. And I love the work you guys are doing at Full Scale. Please keep it up.
All right. Thank you so much, Jeff.
See you later.
Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button, then come find us on Instagram. See you next time. We do it.